Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site. Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
Episode 57.
With guest co-host,
Fitlish. I don't really have it, but did we play a couple games?
Probably not.
I don't think so. Maki, yes. Mm-hmm. We were involved in one of the games, yeah, for at least one.
Yeah, DVMs and stuff.
Yeah, the very slow games.
I know.
And then Dan, of course, is just, well, Dan is Dan.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it, thanks.
You'll know me as Wittlich. People call me Witt for short, but it's actually pronounced with a V because it's a German word, a German town that I adopted, if you will. I spent 16 years in Germany while I was in the military and fell in love with that town. And so I just use that as my handle.
Dude, I'm not going to call you Witt because that's too close to witty, and I don't think you've earned that yet.
Yeah.
You've not earned it yet.
We should take a moment and thank everyone who voted for Polycast in the Best Produced and Gaming categories.
Yes.
In the 2008 Podcast Awards for the 2-week period, October 23rd to November 6th.
Can you remember the Civ4 tech tree by heart? And to the thread starter, I have to say, nerd.
I do not have it memorized by heart. I'm familiar with it, but to really know exactly, I have to double check myself. Whatnot, I don't have it memorized.
See, I thought that's what the Civlopedia was for, so I don't have to remember this all the time.
Well, exactly, yeah.
I need to remember other things, you know.
You could look it up.
Now, of course, the earlier one's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go into the mid and later game, now I have to double check it again.
Yeah, certain parts you remember, like, oh yes, I want to get to this technology because it will allow me to found a religion.
Right. I need code of laws because I need courthouses. Okay, yes.
But like, oh, I remember where Divine Right is in the tech tree, and it gives me blah, 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 blah.
Right, yeah, I don't even know what... You need something before Divine Right. I mean, I'd have to double-check that again.
I'm pleased to see that no is winning in the poll on this.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. It actually shows that people actually have a real life. No slam on the person who started the thread, whoever... Who are they?
No, I think we need to slam. They need to know that this is not good behavior.
Well, their username is a little awkward to verbalize. He is Gen V and then space square bracket FP and then N square bracket.
Carry the one.
Carry the one. It sounds like he would have the tech tree memorized then.
Because he says, I can. The tagline under his username says, website moron.
Well, okay, with a grain of salt then.
Although, I suppose we could ask a related question. After, can you remember the Civ4 tech tree by heart? It could be, do you wish you could remember the Civ4 tech tree by heart? And my answer is still no.
It would kill me. No.
No.
No. It's just a click away if I have any questions.
New hot seat mode. Not that I care that much about hot seat to begin with.
But then, Dan, you could play against yourself and always win.
Maybe.
Me and my multiple personalities. Sir Snuggles.
Sure, sir. Oh, that's a masculine name.
He says, with this new patch, I noticed that Hot Seat now allows for 11 civilizations to play as opposed to 8 before, equal to the standard number for single player. What I've been doing lately is playing as 2 or 3 of the civs and fighting myself.
Talk about being bipolar.
As we said. What a tie-in.
Playing as all 3 French leaders at the same time and seeing which one of the 3 can win.
Oh, get a life. Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that.
I bet he knows the entire tech tree.
There you go.
Oh, Troy, you have to say it that way. Now we've got to send royalties to William Shatner.
No, like I said, like the hot seat here in my office, I have 4 computers, for God's sake. So you're saying you can play with 11 people on a hot seat. Wouldn't that get a little crowded around that computer if you have 11 people?
How can you keep everyone from peeking?
Thank you.
Don't look.
Everyone else turn around. Okay, it's my turn.
I kind of like the idea of playing all 3 leaders of 1 faction, though.
That would be novel. I never really tried it, though.
Yes, it would be novel.
Don't know if it...
And weird.
Weird. Weird. I don't know how long it would keep my attention before I'd be like, okay, enough of this. I need my personality as 1 personality. I can't split them up into 3 or 4 different personalities.
Me is such a jerk, but myself is very creative.
Aha.
I wonder what I, as I, am going to do about it.
Listen, we talked about swapping things in your queue. Somebody needed help with inflation. The Civ 4 version of Infinite City Sprawl. And how far is far for a great merchant?
With Forum Talk, the anti-human bias in Civ 4.
Lastly, two miscellaneous topics. First, debriefing the demographic screen in Civilization 4. And second, how powerful is your computer?
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Swapping. I know that I've used it a couple times, changing things that I've already had in the build queue, and I decide that, oh no, I need a bank, and come back to what I was working on before. I've just noticed that when you do that, you don't lose your production, within reason. But if you take a long time getting back to what you were building before, it seems like the hammers start leaking out.
Yes, they decay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think about 10 turns is when it starts decaying. You have a little grace period in case you need to make an emergency swap.
Is that regardless of your game speed, it's 10 turns, or is it prorated for game speed?
Ooh, good question.
Ooh, I don't remember, because I usually play on normal. Let's put it this way, I know it's 10 turns on normal.
I like to play on quick, because it's a nice ego boost. Someone by the username of Vicawoo.
Vicawoo!
Says if you're going to switch civics, almost completing one of each unit and then finishing them after you switch gives you higher experience units.
Really?
I haven't seen that. That sounds like incredible micromanagement if that's true. And
yeah, you got to remember to do that. I've never heard of that.
No, Cabert says it's hardly a cheat, more like a small trick. Well, it's a trick, but.
It's definite micromanaging, yeah. I mean, what else is there with queue swapping? We do know that you can swap the queues. Hammers do eventually start leaking out, bottom line, if you didn't get back to what you were building before.
So it's hammer arbitrage.
It really.
Can help.
I cannot say this enough. Cottages, cottages, cottages. Courthouses and markets would be nice, too.
With the side helping more cottages.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, just to clear up that Super Dave 23075 ran into a problem in his late game. His inflation rate usually goes through the roof around 1900. So his last game, his total expenses per turn were 225, but 99 of that was for inflation. And what he wants to know what to do to combat his inflation levels. And the first response, I think, is the funniest, win the game before 1900.
One of the civics that you use, it takes care of your distance costs for your capital.
State property?
State property?
Yeah, that sounds all right.
That would do a lot to help your inflation cost.
Yeah, because you have no maintenance costs from distance to palace of your cities.
Correct. And that will just rape you over time, especially if you start spreading out.
Yeah, that's another thing. Even if you have a lot of cities in your empire, if you keep them more compact, it's not so bad. Because you're losing less to the distance.
Right.
Now, this person, SuperDave23075, notes that he is running, in terms of his civics, universal suffrage, which is a medium upkeep, serfdom, which is low, nationhood, which has none, free market, which is medium upkeep, and so is theocracy. But mentioned already state property, courthouses. You should have courthouses in your cities.
Absolutely.
You also want to be, as a number of people point out, yes, doing what you can to get inflation down, but getting more gold in order to combat the increasing maintenance costs that you see. So you want all of your gold production buildings. You want your banks. You want your markets. You want your grocers. You want to be, for instance, building, you know, custom houses and harbors as well, of course, where you have coastal cities to increase the yield of your trade routes. One person suggests selecting a leader with the organized trait.
Yeah, I guess that would help. I myself don't usually worry too much about that. The main thing, if your infrastructure and all your cities are in place, all the buildings, like you said, the marketplaces, the banks, whatnot, and cottages, organized would probably help, but how much, I haven't really noticed that much of a big difference for myself.
Civic upkeep is then reduced 50%. That's helpful, but as you said then, if you're going to say, well, I guess I always have to choose someone with an organized trait, that's going to be limiting your gameplay experience.
Very.
Don't count on it. If you've got it, then great, but that's more of an incidental bonus sort of a thing, such as if you happen to be running Beyond the Sword, and this person is not, he's running the Warlords expansion. Some people refer to the random event, which I've never seen, Federal Reserve random event, where you have free market Civic running, so if this guy was playing Beyond the Sword, he'd have that, and has at least 100 gold and the corporation technology, you get a choice of minus 10% inflation or pay 200 gold and then get minus 25% inflation.
Oh, I never received that.
No, now I'm annoyed every single time I play the game and I don't get it. I'm going to curse. Who else mentions? Also some situational sort of things. S.Ilver talks about the Zulu unique building and the Holy Roman Empire unique building because they reduced maintenance of cities before inflation is stacked upon them. Well, that Holy Roman Empire thing is not going to help Super Dave 23075 at all because he's not playing Beyond the Sword. And, of course, that's when the HRE was introduced.
Correct.
But I think what we're boiling down to here is that to combat inflation, do what you can to generate more gold. Watch how large your empire is in terms of how far the spacing of your cities are. And in terms of making more gold, that's through various buildings that we have mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And cottages, of course.
Right.
And cottages. That is, of course, more important on the higher difficulty levels. Noble and above, you really cannot ignore cottages.
Let me ask you a question. Did anyone mention cottages?
I'm not sure.
In case we weren't clear.
And, you know, be smart about where you put your cottages.
Oh, absolutely. You're right.
Don't stick them on hills.
And really, if you've got, say, a grassland and a plain, say, put them on a plain and put a farm on a grassland instead, because you will get more food output from that.
Absolutely.
And now, of course, this brings up some kind of an underlying question. What a pain in the butt this inflation is. Why even have it at all? CC Runner 7 notes, I agree that it's not the most fun aspect of the game, but without it, it would be easy to run 100% science the entire second half of the game.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'd agree with those exact specifics, but yes. It's not that inflation as an idea itself is bad. How it is implemented, there are certainly some aspects that we would like to see that you'd be able to attack inflation directly as opposed to, oh, more cottages, more gold-producing buildings. Oh, gotta have my cities closer together. Something to attack inflation directly would be preferred, but it is manageable.
And it's a challenge. It's just an added challenge.
And if it's really bothering you that much and you're having that much difficulty, then go to a lower difficulty level.
Correct.
Or, of course, as Dave McW said and was already pointed out, win the game before 1900. Either or.
Win it in the DCs, then you won't have any inflation problems.
Infinite City Sprawl, I thought that Beyond the Sword did a lot to try to counter it. I guess it still exists to a certain degree, but if you're sprawling, you're going to pay the maintenance cost is going to start killing you if you start cranking out cities left, right, and center without having the infrastructure for the cities to mature first. My take on it.
Yeah, we've really seen that since Civ 4 itself, even in vanilla.
Right. Yeah, because before it was he who builds the most cities first wins.
Lord Mac Crower asks, what are your thoughts on using an Infinite City Sprawl type city formation in Civ 4? What would be the benefits and downsides of such a strategy? And so ICS for short, use a lot of acronyms in Civ, of course, as with anything, so we'll refer to it as ICS mostly from this point, I'm sure. An example of that in Civ 4, as is put forward by someone in this thread, is, for instance, building a city and then three tiles over in any direction, building another city, where you've got squares of cities.
Oh, it may look pretty in the beginning. But you're talking that they're overlapping, or are they perfectly, with the fat cross, interconnecting?
No, they're overlapping.
They're definitely overlapping.
You're not respecting the potential full fat cross limit.
See, and that's the thing. It may look pretty at the beginning, but at the end it's going to turn into a nightmare, trying to have the cities to grow.
Exactly, and if the strategy You might have a little bit of an ICS, although I wouldn't call it an infinite city sprawl then. It would be like a finite city sprawl where in a very situational moment you decide, oh, I want to grab that resource before somebody else, especially if you're single player in the AI, happens to plunk it there to get that particular resource, and you're thinking either, well, it's not going to be in the fat cross, or even if it is going to be in the fat cross, it's going to take a while for it to become into my fat cross. And I need to be able to grab that resource now because that will be my only resource of iron, for instance. And we discussed, I think it was last episode, how it's unfortunate that we don't have colonies as in Civilization 3. And you know, we don't use that sentence very often. We wish Civilization 4 had been Civilization 3 was. But you need to pay attention when we say these things. There'll be a quiz later. So, Our Rollo 1 refers to it's from Beyond the Sword, version 3.13 from earlier this year, called Infinite City Sprawl 2, Cities in Conscription, Victory at Rifling Succession Game on CFC, which was a successor to the first Infinite City Sprawl from February, March of this year. Only the first one was at Emperor level, and this next one went to Immortal level.
Please.
Yeah, every city had to be exactly 3 tiles removed from another of their cities. This places all of our cities in a perfect square grid, tight as possible. If you go to the last page, there's a post that notes, it actually ended on a conquest victory in 1816 for the person playing with this limitation in terms of how to space the cities. They got an Augustus Caesar rating with a score of 124,951.
Good for them.
So now, I'm not saying, with degrees of separation, I'm not saying if you adopt this ICS in your game, then you will win the game and have an Augustus Caesar rating of 120 plus thousand. No, it's saying that it can be done even at the higher difficulty levels and not be too much of a drawback, certainly in the longer run, that you can't make a go of it.
Okay.
So again, I think when it comes to ICS, the benefit of state property, courtesy of the communism technology, comes into play. Now, it's true that your cities aren't as spread out, but eliminating maintenance is eliminating maintenance, whether it's 10 or 100.
One way or the other, yeah, right.
Pope Jubal recommends the spiral minaret wonder, plus shrine, plus a corporation for, quote, equaling instant profit for every new city, and a large profit once you get a temple and courthouse built. Unquote. The spiral minaret gives you plus 2 gold from all state religion buildings until it obsoletes at computers. The shrine building will give you plus 1 gold per city with your state religion and spreads religion, and of course can only be constructed in the holy city where the religion was founded. So hopefully, in that case, the holy city is the city that you control when you captured it, right? Just a little caveat
right
there.
And if you don't control it, yes. Take it.
And we talked about courthouses in previous segment, again, minus 50% maintenance. So that's all sounding good, except that choosing to build the spiral minaret wonder, that sounds like rationalization in order to build that wonder, and I really have no interest in it.
Basically, yeah, because I have built it in the past myself, but basically just like, if the opportunity arose, okay, I'll build it. But I really don't plan on building it from earlier in the game, you know, leading up to it, with the goal of building it.
Yeah.
It's just if it happens, it happens.
Ironin recommends the Great Lighthouse Wonder, which gives you plus 2 trade routes in coastal cities, obsoletes with corporation. And of course, when it obsoletes with corporation, then you can come into having the corporation aspect. And indeed, one point in this thread, Dave McW says, ICS, in fact, infinite corporation spam. I believe that's what the new ICS would be for Beyond the Sword, infinite corporation spam. The new ICS, ICS, the next generation. Do-do-do-do-do.
Hey. No humming, no singing, you know the rules.
No geeking out.
Well, this is a podcast about a game. I think we're a little late for the no geeking out rule.
So really, I think a lot of the recommendations for if you're going to have Infinite City Sprawl is, again, kind of the response to having too much inflation, which is have a combination of both buildings and civics and, in the case of ICS here, some wonders that will help increase your gold income.
I would have to concur. Now, I do have a question to everyone here on the panel concerning the next topic of the great merchant. How far is far? Every time I get a great merchant, I use him mainly for the gold aspect. Put him on a caravel, send him out to another country, and cash in to get the gold right then and there. Does everyone use him that way, or do you use him for wonders, or what do you use the great merchant for?
It's usually for the cash, but I'm thinking...
The cash is nice.
Does anybody, like, make him join?
Doesn't one of the corporations need a great merchant?
I think so.
Because I can't remember.
I believe so, but I've not been that big on the corporations.
Well, I love sushi.
With the great merchant, it seems mostly, yeah, is money-wise, and maybe it would benefit from our reworking. I think we talked about last time about making religions only being able to be founded with a great prophet, and perhaps corporations should have a great merchant in order to be founded.
Now, that would make sense.
Because right now it's just like, all right, free cash.
Right. So that's what I use for, you know.
In order to found the Sushi Corporation, you need a great merchant.
There you go. Okay.
That's the only corporation that the great merchant requires. But if you get the great merchant early on in the game, I'm not going to sit on it.
Mm-mm.
No.
For Sushi.
No. Especially if you really need the cash earlier in the game as well, where you can afford to keep your science up and whatnot and run a deficit. That few thousand gold would help. It goes a long way.
Exactly.
Yeah, either running a deficit and or, I admit, I like to, as long as they have some decent promotions associated with them anyway, upgrading units, which of course can be a costly endeavor.
Right. When you do cash them into a foreign city, if it's inland, the cash you receive is not as much as you would on a coastal city. And of course, high population of that city. Now, I know that they say, like, great merchant, how far is too far? The further distance it goes, the more cash you get, too.
Hmm.
Yeah, but if you're on a Pangea, sometimes you don't have much of a choice.
Well, that's true. Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, just find the biggest city that's the furthest from me and see how much I get.
The profit of a trade mission, as noted by Dan F5771, is equal to 500 plus 200 times the capital trade profit, where capital trade profit is the income this city would get for a trade route to your capital. All modifiers are factored in. First one being harbor.
Yep.
Indeed, being on a coastal city, far away from you, as we were also saying, and being on a coastal city, as well as the city size. City size is apparently the third factor, and apparently, I didn't realize this, so is if you have the Temple of Artemis Wonder, which, I'm thinking, really? But then if you look up the Artemis Wonder, it gives you plus 100% trade route yield.
Ah, okay.
Now, it does go obsolete with scientific method, but if you know where the Temple of Artemis is located and you can see it on the map and you can get the Great Merchant there, I mean, there's no point in sending your Great Merchant to the city with the Temple of Artemis if you're at war with that.
Good luck on getting them through.
That's not going to work. Also, take into account the connection to the capital.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's overseas, of course, not going to be possible on Pangea, for instance. As also take into account peacetime. Although it's not explained, I'm assuming that peacetime being the amount of time you have been at peace with the nation that's associated with that city.
Hmm.
He also says, since the base profit of a trade route is the minimum and then size of other city and plot distance divided by 10, you should always attempt to have a big capital, saying wait for growth before starting missions. Well, maybe that's ideal.
Right.
The other thing you could do is you could always settle your great merchant, and the only time I have really settled a great merchant is if for some reason or another I've got a city and it grew and now it's starving. Because, of course, the great merchant will give you plus one food, which is the only specialist that will give you food.
Oh, I never even noticed that. I never even paid attention to that. So that may be something, yeah.
Now, sometimes that can also be beneficial to settle a great merchant in a marginal city to give it that one extra population boost so you can say, oh, I can actually be working that resource.
Right.
Well, why don't you just work the resource to begin with? Well, your city's not going to grow to be able to work that resource. And then it's like, oh, no, now it's run out and I can't quite get that. But, I mean, that's all very situational.
So how far is too far? It depends. On a lot of factors. Harbor, but yeah, it's yeah.
Always the best answer.
You know, we could really say that for any topic we've pretty well ever done on this show. It depends.
It depends, yes.
Next.
Inflation help? It depends.
It depends.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
There is a definite anti-human bias with the AIs, of course. Is it a feature? Considered a challenge? And one thing I do have to agree, which is very disheartening, playing against with the AIs, I can discover 10, 20 spies in my territory being caught, left, right, and center. They don't take any hit. But God forbid, if one of my spies should be discovered in their territory, I will take a hit, and that hit will remain for the rest of the game. That's a little annoying. However, is it a feature? Is it a challenge? Yeah, sure. I mean, it's not a game breaker or anything, but it's a double standard. And as far as, you know, if the AI is ganging up on the human, well, yes, but it makes the game a challenge.
Yeah, they're supposed to gang up on us.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it would be far too easy.
Then it would be far too easy for you to manipulate the AIs.
Yeah, you don't just get an alliance just out of not bothering them. You actually have to work for it now.
Right. And if you're having a heartburn with anti-human bias, then there's always that easy way of playing at a lower level. I mean, quite frankly.
It's hard to play under pre-settler.
That's true, too.
I wouldn't go so far as to label it as an anti-human bias, though.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't use that term. That's like a qualitative thing. Having a bias really is a human thing.
Right.
Now, if you want to say the people who designed the game set it up so that there is an anti-human bias, but the game itself...
Right.
And for reasons has already been said, it's towards the challenge, and so that you cannot take advantage of the AI, because, amazingly, most people who play Civ are smarter than the AI.
Right.
Wow, that went right by. I said,
no, most. You're right. But humans could also learn from their mistakes and change their plans. The AIs, you're still hard-coded certain things that they will do and follow.
I set up a trap and keep giving them a beating, and they don't learn not to move there.
You're right. Civ 4, it does not think for itself. Maybe we can keep that for Civ 5.
I would like the ignore button, though. Wait, Montezuma's talking? You're on permanent ignore.
Oh, absolutely.
Ignore.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing with their silly demands, where if you give in to them, okay, you get a plus one.
Yes.
But if you say no, or just enough get out of my face, you take that hit and it's going to be there. I've never seen it go away once it was there.
You refuse to give us tribute. Well, you suck. That's why I refuse to give you tribute.
Right. I mean, the AI, you try to contact the AI, and they're like, we don't want to talk to you. And that's it. But why don't we have the button for them also, saying, I don't want to deal with you right now.
Exactly. Quit popping up. I have other things to concentrate on.
Yes, the inner workings of the demographic screen explained. Exposé.
So does Dan have the dirt on that?
I sure do.
Ooh.
This thread was started by Robbie D. back in March of 2006, last updated in August of last year, so it was current with Beyond the Sword only to 3.02.
Okay.
Although, as far as I'm aware, I'm not really sure the 3.17 patch changed much of anything with regards to it. But anyway.
I wouldn't think, yeah.
So it's current to Beyond the Sword 3.02, and for you, Super Dave out there, it's current to Warlords 2.13 and Vanilla 1.74. The post addresses the graphs, demographic screen, but then the so what does it all mean category is probably the most useful. Most interestingly, actually, is on gross national product, or GNP,
mm-hmm.
which may seem useless in Vanilla and Warlords. So, Super Dave, you can stop listening right now. But for those of us in, with Beyond the Sword, apparently it, quote, takes on a different meaning. It becomes an indicator to the overall prosperity of a nation rather than just an indication of how much commerce tiles are being worked. This makes it more useful in judging how well a nation is off, because to get a high GNP, you need to have improvement in all areas to generating extra commerce, research, culture, and espionage, unquote. So, one interpretation of that is, if they have a high GNP, get ready to pillage.
Okay.
Cottages.
That's my translation. On manufacturing goods and crop yields, regardless of what Civ 4 version we're talking about here, quote, can be very useful on in the early game when there are only a few cities because it can clearly show whether an opponent is concentrating on building military units or population growth, unquote. He doesn't say that it's not useful in the late game, but I'm going to interpret that that's what he's saying. He just didn't want to say it.
Hmm.
Approval rate and life expectancy, which, of course, I typically pay attention to approval rate, but life expectancy is just kind of like, meh, well,
yeah.
Well, Robbie D. says, quote, show you the potential nations have for future population growth in their cities, as high numbers in both of these categories means that there's plenty of room to add population points to cities without having unhappy people or unhealthy people.
Ah, okay.
This is especially true in the early part of the game. Numbers around 50% mean they have reached the limit, while numbers below 50% show they have overstretched their resources and could be vulnerable. Now, I could see that from approval rate, and I would never have made the connection to life expectancy.
Nor would I. I would think it's like, well, if a civ is going to war all the time, they'd have a low life expectancy. But it has nothing to do with them going to war or not.
I mean, it could have something to do with war, but not necessarily.
Right, right.
I've never made a decision to go to war with someone because, oh, their life expectancy is only 40. Or their approval rate is 60.
Mm-hmm.
For soldiers, I always like...
Always.
I'm really not looking at in terms of who everyone else is, but I'm looking at where I am relative to everybody else. I mean, sure, I like looking at my number, but I like to see my rank.
Yeah.
If you're at the bottom of the rank, get ready for someone to declare war on you. If you're number one, people, the AIs even, leave you alone for the most part.
Yeah, I don't need a power graph and beyond the sword, need my espionage up to know that if I'm at the bottom of the soldier ranking list, I'm in trouble.
You're at the top of the target list.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, interestingly enough, Robbie D. says that this can be a little deceptive when gauging an opponent, and it is not based entirely on the units. It seems to be a combination of actual power and potential power put together, so you have to do a bit of investigating as to why an opponent is rated as powerful as they are. This can be very difficult to read in the early part of the game, as one change can make a big difference, quote-unquote. Well, of course, because you don't have as many units then, and an additional unit, as in terms of a total earlier on in the game, is a greater percentage boost, of course.
Well, isn't having barracks even affect it? If you start having barracks in all your cities, wouldn't that up your power? Barracks and stables. I'm not sure how true it is.
Yeah, I would assume so. That sounds logical.
Because that would go for your potential.
Right.
Of higher promoted units.
Hopefully that does have an impact. As you've probably heard on the show before, Troy, we have lots of gameplay versus realism discussions, but sometimes realism should be in gameplay, and that should be in gameplay.
Right. Okay.
This is a red letter day. I said something like that. Wow. He says the best way to find out is getting an open border agreement and poking around a bit. From there, you can see how their power stacks up to yours and if you can win, unquote. Well, another option is to send in a spy.
And not get caught.
And then finally, imports and exports.
Mm.
I look at that, and I really don't lose any sleep over it. I kind of get alarmed maybe if one of the values is a negative, but I'm really looking at the ratio. But I really don't care what they say the best is or the worst is.
Mm-hmm. It all ties back, are you yourself running at a deficit or not?
Yes.
If I'm making gold and my science is at an adequate level, I don't pay attention to it either much.
No, I'd rather look at the relations screen. I don't think that's the proper name for it. Where I can see, like, the active relations, and I can see who's trading for what and for how much and whether it's coming or going, whether it's an import or an export.
Right.
Robbie D. says, quote, not very important when it comes to measuring the strength or prosperity of a nation, unquote, of course, but he says it still gives you some useful information, quote, because to have trade routes, you need to have open border agreements with other nations, and therefore how many potential friends they may have in future conflicts, unquote. Well, I'm still not convinced there, Robbie D.
Well, we all know that the AI is ganging up against human anyways, so... Nice to know, but not dire information.
Now, he does, rightly so in this point, about, quote, the ratio gives you an idea of how much a nation has invested in infrastructure like harbors, etc., which give trade bonuses, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it gives you an idea of how much. You have no idea whether they've got harbors in all their coastal cities or none, necessarily.
Correct.
The demographics screen, there are always certain aspects of it that I enjoyed reading, as we said, depending, I guess I shouldn't say enjoyed because it depends on whether the numbers are good or not, but it is important to see.
It's something that you would check out, yes.
Really going back to approval rate, I'd rather look at individual cities and see whether or not I've got unhappy faces in there, rather than looking at an approval rate, but I still look at that. The population indicator, that's kind of an interesting thing. I would say the soldiers thing is really the key one that I look at on that screen.
Same here.
We all have our own idea of what each of those items mean, but what I found most interesting about that thread is discussing how it actually applies in-game. and whether or not our assumptions were true.
Especially the life expectancy. That one I did not know.
Since we've got the graphs in Civ 4, I'd much rather look at the graphs to get an idea of the relations.
Yeah, a lot of times when I look at the graphs myself, I have to click down on the drop-down for the last 50 turns. Because you go through the whole game, especially after I get done doing unit upgrades across the board.
Oh, gosh.
Then I wait a turn and go in there and do the last 50 turns and see me shoot up as I compare to my opponents. I'm wondering about this thing. How powerful is your computer? Is this just a talking, bragging discussion, or what?
Absolutely. Of course.
My computer can beat up your computer.
Any day of the week.
I use a Pentium 2 with 32 megs of RAM.
Bam!
See, what is mine? Mine's an Intel Pentium D, 3.2 gigahertz, with 2 gigabytes of RAM. There are 7 fans inside this machine.
Ooh.
And it glows blue.
Oh, mine glows blue as well.
And I also have a Pentium 4 with 2.8 gigahertz.
Eww.
And 4 gigabytes of RAM.
I have, well, I run Vista. And I have an AMD Athlon.
Oh, one of the fake processors.
Hey, what's wrong
with an Athlon? Dang it. Athlon 64 dual core with 3 gigs of RAM. A GeForce 7800 GT with 256 megabytes of VRAM.
Ugh.
And a widescreen monitor.
Oh, just love it when you talk dirty.
Oh, yeah. You love it. You love it.
Wow, Imran's computer sounds almost exactly like my computer.
Uh-oh.
Except I have a different graphics card.
Maybe they're twins.
I had an 8600 GT card, but the fan on it started being weird, so I had to replace it with a lesser card for the time being.
Oh, no.
Oh, no!
I know, it sucks. Stuff has started lagging. It wasn't lagging, dang it.
Your fan started to get weird, huh?
The fan on the graphics card.
Mackie turns her computer on. She hears the fan. Vroom, vroom. Whoa! I have a Intel dual core E8500. That's 3.1 gigahertz, 3 gig of RAM.
Woo!
GeForce 8800 GTS with 512 meg radio RAM, Windows XP Service Pack 2, and I also have an older computer, which is a Pentium 4. It's 2.8 gigahertz. It's got 1 gigabyte of RAM, then it has a 128 megabyte video card. It's like a 6600 or something like that.
Right.
It appears all of us have fairly powerful machines.
Well, if you play Civ.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at polycast@polyfin.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show, Modcast,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.polyfin.net.
Actually win on immortal levels and whatnot, it's a deity or whatnot, it's great for them. I've actually sat back and tried my hand at it, and every time, like clockwork, I get my ass handed to me on a platter. Like, this is, I don't know how they do it, but good for them. And the only way I could probably think of that at that higher levels is you'd have to really be concentrating on your military. If you back up on the AI getting ahead of you militarily-wise, you're going to be toast. Have any of you all played at the higher levels? Tried it.
No.
Tried it. Oh.
Once, and I got pasted, and I said, no, thank you.
Exactly. It's like, well, this is just not fun anymore.
Like, this sucks. Run away, run away.
Unless you like that sort of thing.
Unless you like, yeah, exactly.
Do you like that? Do you like getting beaten to a pulp?
Mm-hmm. Do you like being smacked?
Well, yes, I like Alpha Centauri a lot.
Who remembers Civ 1?
Oh, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I used to play CivNet, as a matter of fact. The first one, the multiplayer.
Oh, you are a bear for punishment.
Yes, yes. But I still have it, as a matter of fact. I'll load it up, and I'm like, okay, I've gotten spoiled now. At first, it's like, oh, reminiscing. I'm like, okay, the graphics just suck. I'm spoiled now, that's it. But I liked, what was it, Civ 2 with the advisors? I miss the advisor screen.
Oh, yeah.
That comes up in the forums a lot. That comes up on this show a lot. Yeah.
I really miss those advisors.
Wasn't there a Civ 2 expansion that actually disabled the High Council? Was that Test of Time?
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, you don't have to talk to the Council.
No.
If you just don't want to hear from them, you just don't answer them.
That's right.
That's it. Or you disable or whatever type thing.
What was really annoying is that they disabled it, yet it was still on the menu. Like, you could still see High Council, and you click on it, did nothing.
Just teasing. Just a tease, yeah, yes.
Barbarian farming for experience points.
My aspect of it, in the early game, sure, you can get your experience points for the farming and whatnot type thing. But I think it's a short-lived.
Yep.
Instead of using for farming, I end up just wiping them out and having done with it. Before, you know, keeping their city alive, so I'll know that they'll be spawning more warriors for me to use them as a target practice. But they have a iron or copper, and they start doing with the axemen and whatnot, then, okay, enough. And you what? You can only go up to, what, 5 experience points, is it?
5 on animals and 10 on barbarians.
Okay, so once you reach the 10, well, then they're just a nuisance.
Yeah, but it's key. You can get your city garrison units that maybe won't see as much experience out there and then get a little bit, so they have an extra promotion or two that way.
True.
Yeah, the smart thing to do is to recognize, okay, this unit is now at 10 XP, time to select another unit to go after those barbarians.
Right.
Actually, in the same game where I had that random event, I was attacking a civilization, and they kept sending out caravels for some reasons, and I had attack subs and destroyers, and...
target practice.
I got XP, so...
Not to mention probably a couple of great generals.
Yes, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's the other good use for them.
And that thread was started by Spearbeardy. I know he'd be very disappointed if he listened to this, and then we could say his
okay.
Name.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Gonna cover our bases.
You know, though, when I heard the title, I'm like, wait, why are we planting vegetables in barbarians?
Why would I send workers over to a barbarian city to improve their terrain?
I don't understand.
I thought maybe Imran's reaction might have been barbarian farming for XP, but I run Vista.
Oh, that's good.
No.
I'm sorry, I cannot participate in this topic because I do not have XP.
Well, this has been episode 57 of Polycast, an official podcast of a Polton Civilization site. I'm still Makalua, and I was joined today with Dan Quick.
I need a little more help than a little bit.
I'll say. Imran Siddiqui.
Bye.
And our guest co-host, Vitlich.
Ah, thank you for having me.
Isn't that Vitlich?
Vitlich.
Vitlich. Yeah. I was closer.
Vitlich.
Oh, yep, come on. Yep. Everybody mispronounces my name. I can mispronounce somebody else's once in a while.
That's why we all call you Maki.
Exactly.
That's why we let you have the opportunity to call him Down Care.
Thank you.
We should actually thank the fellow Apolitoners for putting up with us.
Ooh.
If they're still listening at this stage of the game.
Yeah, seriously, why do you guys keep encouraging us?
Oh, but Dan has a question to ask you.
Oh, yes.
Who, me?
As usual.
Now that you've been a guest on the show, Troy, would you be willing to come back again?
Oh, absolutely. It was a hoot. Good time was had, by me at least. It was fun. Hello.
Is Dan here?
Oh, I hear you very faintly. Oh,
I knew Canada was far away, but damn.
F***ing hell.
Modern technology.
The next person on the list to do it is Mickey.
Wait a minute. Dang it.
Actually, it would be Anna Lee, but she's not here, so.
Anna Lee. Shaking my fist, you can't see it. This has been episode
Epicac?
This has been Maki getting tongue-tied as usual.
Insert Tongue Tied by Faber Driver.
Hey.
Hey, I could have sung it, so count your blessings.
Count it.
Record date?
November 8, 2008.
Sound Clips Copyright Civilization 4 and the Warlords and Beyond the Sword Expansion Packs. Copyright 2008, Appleton Civilization site at appleton.net.